Hong Kong was once the free media hub of Asia, home of great newspapers in English and Chinese. Those mastheads survive, or most of them, but their old free voices are long tamed. They're not disagreeing with Beijing now. A couple of years before the Brits handed Hong Kong back to China in 1997, a rag-trade tycoon called Jimmy Lai threw some of his fortune into a progressive tabloid called the Apple Daily that became, as China tightened its grip on the old colony, a rabble-rousing voice for liberty. Beijing shut it down in 2021. The last issue, bidding farewell to its readers, sold a million copies. Jimmy Lai was arrested at the same time and has been in prison ever since. Last year, he was found guilty on one count of sedition and two counts of colluding with foreign forces. Last week, at the age of 78, Jimmy Lai was sentenced to 20 years behind bars. Joining me now is an old friend of the show, Anthony Dapperin, lawyer, writer, and photographer who was based in Hong Kong for many years. His most recent book is City on Fire, The Fight for Hong Kong. But he joins me now from Melbourne. Welcome to the show, Anthony.
Thank you.
Anthony, what was Jimmy Lai's crime?
His crime was carrying out a range of activities that in Australia and many other places around the world would have been considered free speech and free association. He was an advocate and an activist. He published a newspaper, the Apple Daily, that was very critical of the Chinese and Hong Kong governments. He wrote articles. He posted social media posts. He appeared on podcasts and media appearances. He met with foreign politicians and sought their support for the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong. And he supported a crowdfunding advertising campaign internationally seeking support for Hong Kong. All of these things he did, you know, which would be, I think, anywhere else in the world, political free speech. But in China's eyes, this was regarded as a threat to China's national security.
What was the newspaper like? Descriptions of it make it sound like a pretty raucous affair.
It was irreverent. It was often funny. It was critical of the government, of course, but it also had a very solid dose of typical tabloid fodder. You know, celebrities, crime, and because of that, it was incredibly popular. It had all the things that people love. Celebrities, crime, and politics, and making fun of the government.
It sounds, in a way, like an old-fashioned afternoon paper.
Yeah, it was very much so. And it also had a very distinctive graphic style, big, bold, colourful headlines, colourful photographs, of course, the odd obligatory sort of scantily clad model thrown in there as well. So it was really a colourful, old-fashioned rag, yeah.
And it survived a long time after Hong Kong was handed back to the Chinese. So it was still going strong in the, 2018, 2019. But was the problem then that it took up the cause of those massive demonstrations in Hong Kong?
It was. It had always been a cheerleader for Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement and protest movements, going back really into the immediate post-handover years, as early as 2003, when there were very big protests against a proposed national security law back then. The Apple Daily was supporting that movement and printing signs that were sort of lift-outs from the newspaper that people could take along to the protests and hold up and that sort of thing. But for really the first 20 years or so after the handover, all of this was really tolerated by the authorities in Hong Kong and Beijing, and seen as part of the promise that under one country, two systems, Hong Kong would continue to be allowed to enjoy these freedoms, freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And it was really only when the protests in 2019 took a very strong anti-government turn that China began to see what Lai and the Apple Daily were doing was no longer tolerable.
In 2019, was Beijing's grip on Hong Kong ever in danger?
Given the coercive power they wielded through the Hong Kong police force and ultimately backstopped, if it ever came to that, by the People's Liberation Army, I think there was never any real serious threat to to their rule over Hong Kong. They could always impose it by force if they wanted to, and really they did. But what was at threat was the idea of Hong Kong being a part of China, and of the Hong Kong people seeing their place as a cohesive part of the Chinese nation as a whole. What was really developing in the course of that protest was a strong sense of a distinct Hong Kong identity that had always been there, but that protest movement really began to foster as this idea that, you know, we really are something different from the rest of China. We have things like symbols of nationhood, like a flag and an anthem, began to be circulated during that protest movement in a way that hadn't before. And I think it was this idea of a genuine separate identity that really frightened Beijing the most.
But wasn't there always an advantage for Beijing in this notion of a separate identity, which would allow Hong Kong to remain a huge, vibrant outpost of capitalism?
Yes, very much so. And I think Beijing wanted to have it both ways, really. They wanted to have the capitalist outpost and all the money flows and the things like a separate and freely convertible currency and a capital market that was open to all of the world to fund its companies. But it decided it didn't any longer want the political freedoms that came with that promise. And so I think they've decided, and I think in their minds, they probably managed to achieve a way to have one without the other.
What has been the impact on that capitalist outpost of the contraction of freedoms in Hong Kong? Any impact?
There's certainly been an impact on civil society in Hong Kong and therefore on the daily lives of the people. I think the recent disaster in Taipo, an apartment blaze fire that killed more than 100, close to 200 people, was a good example of the kind of event that in the past would have been met with a very strong civil society response in Hong Kong. There would have been memorials, there probably would have been protests, the independent media would have written and reported on it extensively, student unions would have sort of gathered around the event and sort of had discussions and forums. Civil society groups would have lent aid. All of those things now are gone from Hong Kong. You know, the artistic community has been cowed. Films are censored. Artists that have had sort of expressed pro-democracy sentiments in the past are banned from exhibiting. Independent bookshops are closed down. All those things that bring color to life in a community have gradually been eradicated. So the money still flows, the market still functions, but I think that really it's a city that is being in deep trauma from the sort of the combined blows of the protest movement, the crackdown and COVID and the lockdowns around that, and has never really recovered yet from all of those traumas because it hasn't been given the civic space to do so.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Anthony Dapperin about the state of things in Hong Kong. Anthony, is there anything left of the old democratic framework of Hong Kong?
Certainly not, strictly speaking, from the political system point of view. The legislature has been reformed so that now any candidates running for election have to be pre-approved by Beijing and must prove their patriotic credentials. As a result of that, all of the pro-democracy parties have been prevented from running. 45 of them were jailed for a subversion a couple of years ago. And as a result, all of those pro-democracy parties have since dissolved. Parties that have been around for decades and had formed a large part of the political life of Hong Kong. So all of that is gone. What remains, and really I think the one source of hope, is that the Hong Kong people and their spirit sort of remains there, and the sense that, you know, these are rights that Hong Kong has enjoyed and deserves to enjoy, and ultimately, you know, will one day enjoy again. The promise of some form of democracy is still there in the Basic Law, even though it's sort of been now much scaled back. But I think there's a sense among the Hong Kong people that this isn't over, and ultimately that their right to a democracy and freedoms will one day be realized, even if it's been deferred many years into the future now.
How well is the city being administered under this new system?
Look, Very poorly. The legislature really no longer functions. It's a rubber stamp legislature. And we had a classic example of this just a couple of weeks ago when the government decided they were going to introduce a new law requiring the wearing of seatbelts on public buses. They passed this amendment to the transport laws to require that. There was a great fanfare, a sort of public awareness campaign that now you have to wear a seatbelt on buses. And it was implemented without being thought through thoroughly, and there were many complaints from the public that the belts didn't work or they weren't installed, or what would you do if you couldn't reach the call button to call your stop with your seatbelt on, all those things. Yeah. And then finally, someone realized that the amendment to the law actually hadn't been drafted properly, and it only applied to new buses coming into service as of the beginning of the year. So the whole thing had to be scrapped and they're back to the drawing board again. But it's just this sort of ineptitude around basic governance that is really, unfortunately, a hallmark of Hong Kong today.
At that nitty-gritty level, is the press capable of saying things are going wrong here, things need to be changed, or are they just so cowed that even that's not possible?
Look, they are to a certain extent. They all tread very carefully around it. I think the level of sort of ridicule that the government officials might have once been subjected to in the past in that sort of situation has been much scaled back. One can only imagine the field day that Jimmy Lai's Apple Daily would have had with that back in the day. So that is sort of been scaled back. But it is possible to point out shortcomings in a measured and careful way.
Isn't it interesting how communists and others like that hate jokes?
Yes, that's right. It is really the weak spot of authoritarians around the world, from China to, dare I say it, Washington, D.C. at the moment.
They're awfully thin-skinned.
They are.
But what do you now? I mean, how long were you in Hong Kong for?
I was there for over 25 years. So I moved there in 1999 and came back to Australia just last year.
Right. What do you see is going to happen in Hong Kong? Does it become sort of merged more and more with China? Does it become more and more just like another city like Shanghai, perhaps?
That certainly seems to be the official policy. There is this idea of the so-called Greater Bay Area, where Hong Kong integrates with Shenzhen across the border and Macau and Guangzhou into this large economic block. And as part of that, you can see Hong Kong not just economically, but politically and civically merging with those parts of China. It's still, you know, suits China's purposes, as I said, to keep it a distinct economic unit for all those sort of great global capitalist reasons. But one can see that the border becoming, I think, increasingly porous. Already, people in Hong Kong are heading off to Shenzhen to spend their evenings and their weekends and their disposable incomes, because it's much cheaper than Hong Kong when you go across the border, and people say that the variety of services and things is much better. So already there's a lot of back and forth between Hong Kong and the mainland. And I think that ultimately, and until something changes in Beijing, which is really where Hong Kong's fortunes are decided, Hong Kong will gradually converge with those other mainland cities.
What's happening to English?
It's still an important language. People still learn it at schools. Everyone in government and commerce speaks it. But Mandarin is certainly becoming much more important than it was, certainly assuming at least equal significance with English.
And what about old cultural institutions like the symphony orchestra, like the galleries? I mean, Hong Kong has some marvelous galleries.
It does. And unfortunately, they are also very careful about what they exhibit now. Hong Kong a few years ago launched a wonderful new contemporary art museum called M+, which was donated a very sizable collection of contemporary Chinese art from the 80s, 90s and this century.
Very political stuff.
Very much so, yes. And a lot of it now kept in storage very carefully. Things that had been previously exhibited have been taken off exhibit. For example, a number of works by Ai Weiwei, the famous dissident artist, have been removed. And so, yes, those institutions are very careful about what they exhibit. exhibit. Certainly there's been examples of local theatre groups being denied venues because the idea was that their theatre pieces were considered too subversive to be allowed to be publicly showed. They're never, of course, outright banned, but they're just told that there's, you know, maintenance issues or a booking clash or various reasons. Well, sorry, the venue you booked is no longer available.
Oh, there's a leak in the roof.
Exactly.
You know, we have to fix it. Is it still Hong Kong? Is it still a tourist hub?
Look, I think it's not in the way that it once was. I think the thing that is really sad is the idea of Hong Kong as that place where, you know, it's part of China but not quite part of China. It was that slightly, you know, raucous and wild place where all sorts of things that couldn't happen elsewhere in China could happen in Hong Kong have gone. And with that, sort of the appeal of the place has diminished.
Penny Wong has put out an eloquent plea for the release of Jimmy Lai. Trump months ago said it would be terribly easy to get him out of prison, another prediction of Mr. Trump's that hasn't quite worked out. Marco Rubio has put in a plea for the man to be freed. Keir Starmer has done the same. The UK Foreign Secretary said that his case was being discussed between the British and the Chinese governments at the highest levels. Is any of this going to work? Is there any prospect that this man will actually be released?
Look, not unless Xi Jinping decides that it's in his interests to do so. I mean, you know, there has been widespread condemnation from, as you say, pretty much everyone, but unfortunately, it's condemnation without consequences. And until China and Xi Jinping personally decides that there's something that he can get in return for releasing Jimmy Lai, or it's going to be in his interests in some way to do so, I think, unfortunately, there is very little hope for him.
Thank you so much, Anthony, for joining us on Late Night Live.
It's a pleasure.
I have been talking to Anthony Dapperin, writer, lawyer, and photographer, who has left Hong Kong and is now living in Melbourne. This is Late Night Live.